The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. For this week's episode, I'm going to be circling back to a case that has haunted me and many of you for many years, and that's the 2017 murders of Abby Williams and Kelsey German in Delphi, Indiana. I know most of you listening have been around for a long time. You've heard all the discussions we've had. We've had Bob Mata on several times as there's been developments through the trial and things that have happened since the trial. Well, just this week, on Tuesday, we got some new information released, and that's kind of what we've been waiting for. As I've said many times when we've talked about the case, it's hard for me to have a real solid opinion because we don't have trial transcripts, we don't have the evidence, we don't have the pretrial evidence. All we have is other people relaying what they saw at trial. And as you guys know, when I'm investigating a case, I don't even like to look at the trial as much. I like to go all the way back to the beginning and look at the source material. Well, in this case, Richard Allen's very first, not his first police interview. He was interviewed by the police just the day after the murders occurred. But then 5.5 years passed before he was brought in for questioning again on October 13th, 2022. This Tuesday, a YouTube channel called Crime Circus, they had filed a FOIA request and they got the videos of Richard Allen's police interviews. There were two of them. And they published them on their YouTube channel. So for anybody that wants to see the full interviews, go to the Crime Circus YouTube channel and check them out. Because that's the only place I've been able to find them is on their YouTube channel, I'm not going to play any audio today. I actually did pull the audio off as I was analyzing it throughout this week and thought about dropping in clips. But really, at this point, that's kind of their copyrighted material. They're the ones that filed the FOIA. They're the ones that published it. I don't have any rights to it. So I'm not going to play any of the audio. But that's where you can listen to it and view it if you want to. What I'm going to be doing today is a full statement analysis of this 1 hour and 20 minute long interview. And as you guys know, especially those who've been around for a long time, this is what really interests me about a case. This is the thing that I like doing that I think over the years of being mentored by Jim Clemente and Jim Fitzgerald and Dr. Shiloh and Dr. Scott, that I think I've gotten, I feel like, pretty good at doing these types of statement analysis. So I spent the better part of this week, I spent about 12 hours working on analyzing this video and breaking it down and taking notes. And that's what I'm going to be covering today. It might be a little bit jumbled because I didn't write a script. I'm just going off of after handwriting notes and then typing them out and then retyping them and going back. I've got about 7 pages of notes, single space, 12-point font. that I typed out as I was doing my final analysis. So I'm just going to be going through those notes for today's episode. And I think that you're going to find it really interesting because I did. For most of you that have been listening, you know that I've been really on the fence about Richard Allen's guilt. After the evidence came out at trial, I didn't feel like there was a very strong case against him. After we saw the video that came out, the Bridge Guy video that came out about a month ago, and I covered that, I definitely was led to believe that the state's narrative certainly wasn't true and was still unsure if we were looking at Richard Allen or some other suspect. And given that my perspective is generally that everyone is innocent until proven guilty, I really haven't been inclined at all to even say that I think that Richard Allen is guilty. Because truly, I don't. And that doesn't mean that I think he's innocent. It means I don't see enough evidence to say that I believe he's guilty. Well, now we have a little more evidence to work with. And I went through a real roller coaster going through this episode. And you're going to hear that because I'm going to read my notes in real time. I'm not going to, tee it up for what I found in the conclusion. I'm just going to give you my thoughts that I had as I was watching it. So without me yapping anymore, I'm just going to get right into this. So like I said, the YouTube video is 1 hour and 20 minutes long. That's how long the interview is. When it starts out, Richard Allen is confident. He just says as he's walking in and sitting down, there's no way they're going to convince him that he had anything to do with the murders, so he's not really worried. Sit down and chat for a few minutes, and then during the Miranda warnings, he's actually laughing and joking. When they say that he's free to leave, he actually pretends to get up and leave. Everybody jokes about it and laughs, and then he sits back down. Now, one thing that I want you guys to really focus on in this process, I get questions all the time when we do statement analysis about the Reed technique. What's the Reed technique? This interview is classic Reed technique. Classic, to the T. And I'm going to be speaking about that as we move through it, but also when you watch it, you can see how it works. So I'm going to let you guys know up front, the basics of Reed technique is you start out at the beginning with an interview, and it's all about rapport building. You're trying to get a relationship with them, trying to get the suspect to trust you. You're also trying to establish a baseline during that first phase. Then in the second phase, you move into the interview. Still very laid back, and during the interview phase, what you're trying to do is get the suspect talking and get them to put a story on the record. Then you confront them with evidence and you move into the interrogation phase. You get more aggressive. You start pushing back against their story with evidence, hoping to get them to crack. And you're going to see all three of those phases play out throughout this interview. Now, in this case, the detectives spend about 14 minutes on that first phase, the rapport building and baseline building. They spend 14 minutes doing that. They mentioned that Allen had talked to the police previously and told them that he was on the trails between 1:30 and 3:30. And they're being very nice to him. They're still laughing and joking with him a lot. They're keeping things very light. They offer him a bottle of water. And they just continue to keep it light. They even make sure to kind of laugh and quip with him as they're getting his basic info. They talk about his high school, college, work experience, military experience. They ask him about physical or mental health concerns. Allen talks about the fact that he had had a heart attack back in 2010. He's got various health issues, and he also deals with depression and anxiety. Now, during these first 14 minutes, Allen is sitting with good posture. He's sitting up straight, his hands are in his lap, and he always leans into the table to answer questions. When they ask him a question, he's answering quickly, and he's answering directly, and he's kind of leaning into it. So these are I don't put a lot of weight into body language per se. But again, for me, what I'm trying to do is establish a baseline just like they're doing. What they're doing and what I'm doing when I'm doing my analysis is I'm trying to look and see what does Richard Allen look like when he's comfortable. And they're intentionally keeping him comfortable so they can see what that looks like. Where you hear a lot of people talking about body language and things like that, they talk about, being like a human lie detector. Well, really what you're detecting are not lies. What you're trying to detect is if someone is uncomfortable. And that discomfort can come from the fact that you're lying or several other reasons. So like I said, that first 14 minutes really seems like it was intended to check a box of the Reed technique. They're asking a lot of questions that they already know the answer to, things like Rick's age, address, things like that. They already know the answers to all that stuff. But they're just trying to get him talking and see what he looks like when he's talking about things that he's comfortable with. Then 14 minutes in, they shift into the interview phase. And that's when they ask him to recount his day on the day of the murders. Now, remember, they haven't shown it to him yet. They mentioned that they have it. but they already have a statement from him from the next day. So they want him to put a story on the record. They need material that they can then attack later with evidence and with his prior statements. So Alan begins, he says that he went to his mom's house in Peru, Indiana that morning. Then he said that around 11 or 11:15, his sisters came by and everybody was going to go to lunch. He didn't want to go to lunch, so he decided just to go home at that point. He says that when he got home, it was warmer than usual that day. So he says around noon, he very clearly says he put on a jacket and then he went to the trails. He says that he goes there often and just walks across the bridge and back. He goes on to say that he walked out a little ways onto the bridge to look at the fish and then walked back. He sat on a bench for a little while and then he walked back out of the trails and he left. Now, one thing I noticed is during this part of the interview, Alan is leaning in and watching what the detective is writing down in his notes. So they're sitting, if you're not watching the video, there's a table between them. And the detective has a pile of papers and he's writing stuff down. So Alan is saying stuff to him. And then as the detective starts to write notes, Richard Allen is leaning across the table and like peeking at his notes. Now, this is where things start to get a little bit strange. And that's when they ask Alan where he parked that day. He spirals around for several minutes talking about all the different places that you could park. Now, I can't tell if he honestly doesn't remember where he parked or if he's avoiding the question, because he never actually answers it. They even bring out an aerial map and he still doesn't give a location where he parked. The best we get is it would either have been there or there. But something that jumped out to me is that after several minutes of trying to figure out where he parked, the detective asked Richard if he goes out there often. And when Alan answers, he says, "We," in every single circumstance. Sometimes we'd go once a month. Sometimes we'd go twice in a week. We go out there more often in the summertime. We go out there when we feel like walking the trails. It's interesting to me because he seems to be saying that the trips to the trail are usually trips he makes with his wife. He doesn't talk about going to the trails alone at all. I'm really certain that based on his explanation here, that him going to the trails alone is at the very least not the norm for him, because every single recall of going there is always "we." Now, he also seems to be getting nervous at this point. It's the first time we see a shift in his demeanor and his body language. He keeps grabbing his bottle of water and opening it and taking a sip mid-sentence. He does it over and over again. Now, that's not like some huge tell, but it's worth noting that he wasn't doing that during the rapport-building phase at the beginning of the interview. But whenever they're asking him about where he parked, he tenses up. It's a whole thing, and some people think it's worth studying. Some people think that it's reading tea leaves. But one thing that oftentimes you'll see men do, and it's part of like a limbic system response, is when they're nervous, they'll do things like guard their vital organs, kind of cross their arms. A lot of men and women do that. And then men tend to touch their face in one way or another. Somehow they get their hands up to their face when they're feeling uncomfortable. And in this circumstance, he's not putting his hands on his face, but he keeps going back to that water bottle, keeps taking a sip of water, more so than anybody could be thirsty. It seems to me that he's doing it out of nervousness. And to be honest, this was the first time since we started getting information about the evidence that was presented and the trial, this is the first time I thought, something's not right here. He seems to be hiding something. Why doesn't he want to tell them where he parked? He seemed to have total recall about the trip to his mom's house, about putting on a jacket, about the times when he went. But then where did he park? Which again, this would be an abnormal time for him because usually he goes with his wife, but he went alone. But then when they start just asking him, "Where'd you park on this day?" he's really nervous and doesn't want to answer the question. This is the first time that I began thinking something's not right here.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Next, the detectives, they're actually not. It seems one of them's a detective. The main guy that's asking the questions is an investigator for the prosecution. I'm probably going to be using the word detective interchangeably, but just know the main interviewer is an investigator with the DA's office. He's not a detective. So the investigator then asks him how it came to be that he was ever interviewed back in 2017. And Alan says that he had come home from work that day and his wife told him that they were looking to talk to anyone who had been on the trails on the day of the murder. And he says, quote, obviously, I had told her that I had been there. So we went down to the sheriff's office and talked to the police. Now, that's something that I'm going to ask you to remember because it's going to be relevant next week because there is a second interview and I'll be doing this again next week with that second interview. So I just want you guys to remember that line. Obviously, I had told her that I'd been down there. And then he says that they went down and talked to the police. So he goes on to recount what he remembers now from that day. And he seems pretty relaxed during this part of the interview again. He only tensed up during the part about where he was parking. His posture looks about the same as it did during the baseline phase. He's not grabbing his water bottle every few seconds anymore. He seems like he's chilled out now. So he points out that it's been years and his memory may not be the best, but he thinks he got to the trails around noon. And probably spent an hour or so on the trails. He figures he was probably gone by 1:30 or so. Now, we all know that that is definitely a change from his original statement. His original statement said he got there about 1:30 and he left about 3:30. Now he's saying he got there around noon and left around 1:30. Again, that inconsistency jumped out to me because it's an inconsistency with some obvious utility. But he says that he remembers walking onto the trails and passing three girls at the trailhead that were walking out as he was walking in. He said that he got the impression that one of the girls seemed older and appeared to be watching or babysitting the other two girls. And other than that, he doesn't remember seeing anyone else, no one that jumped out to him. He says that he walked down to the bridge, and again, he says that he walked partway out, he looked at the fish, then sat on a bench for a bit, and then he left. He says that he remembers telling the officer back then that he had seen two vehicles at what he calls the farmer's entrance to the trails. He says that he knows that that's not where he parked that day because he wouldn't have told the officers that he had seen cars there if that's where he had parked. So again, I'm uneasy about this parking situation because he has like this total recall about the events of the morning with his family. He has total recall about how he left his house. He has total recall about the three girls that he saw. He even has total recall about the fact that he saw two cars parked in a particular place, but he dances all around saying where he himself parked. He never, ever answers that question. So at this point, we're about 30 minutes into the interview. And I just want to point out that every single time Alan talks about going out to the trails, because he's doing it here again, he says, we would go. We went. Here again, the detectives are asking him if he'd been to the trails before the day of the murders, and it's all we's. He never says, I would go to the trails. He also still seems very relaxed at this point. Now next, the detectives circle back again to try to pinpoint where he parked that day. And it really feels to me like he's intentionally avoiding committing to a location. The detective tells him that back in 2017, he had told the police that he had parked at the old Farm Bureau building. Now you'd expect the response to that to be the way he responded to everything else when they remind him of what he said in the past. Which is, well, if that's what I said back then that must be right. But every time they come back to the parking spot, he rambles on for several minutes and he never commits. Here on the 31-minute mark, he says, quote, well, if that's what I said, that must be right, but, and then he starts talking about all the other places to park again and runs around in circles again. After that, they ask him how far he went out onto the bridge again. And here, he seems to get nervous again. He's tensing up. He says that he only ever goes out to the first platform. And he kind of avoids the question or at least dances around it. He kind of answers it, but again, deflects talking about how he went all the way across it years ago. He talks about how it's not in as good a shape as it was back then. Then he says, quote, like I said, I usually just go out to the first platform, look at the fish, and then walk back, end quote. It's not complete avoidance, but he's also not actually answering the question directly. Now, another thing I want to point out is that the bridge is 63 feet above Deer Creek. And I really do not like his explanation of what he was doing on the bridge. Now, I'm an avid fisherman, so I get the sentiment of just enjoying watching fish. I've stood on many a bridge and watched fish underneath. But I can say with confidence that this is not what Richard Allen was doing. There's no way. That creek in that area is full of sediment. And there are no big fish species that you could see from 63 feet above. I actually looked it up to make sure that there weren't trout or salmon in Deer Creek. Those are cold water fish, and Deer Creek is a warm water tributary. That's relevant because salmon or steelhead are big, and any kind of trout species feed on the surface and give you something to look at. The largest fish in Deer Creek would be a smallmouth bass. And they're not very big, and they tend to camouflage themselves on the bottom of the creeks and rivers. You add to that the fact that you would need polarized glasses to even have a chance at seeing them. And again, the bridge is 63 feet above the water. So I do not like this detail he gives here at all. It's pretty much provably false, but that's just one of the problems. The utility in the lie is what bothers me. Why lie about what you were doing on the bridge if the real reason you were on the bridge isn't something you're trying to hide from the police? He seems to be replacing whatever it was that he was doing there with this looking at fish story that I can assure you is not true. Now, as the detectives press on for details, Alan just continues to avoid questions. They ask him if he parked at the Farm Bureau building, how did he get to the trail from there? He goes on for about 5 minutes about when they built buildings and parking lots, what vehicles he owned, tells a story about falling asleep and crashing his truck in the past. He's all over the place, and again, he never commits to how he got to the trail. And then, completely unprompted, Alan starts talking about what car he was driving that day. He goes on and on about what car he normally drives and why and what his wife drives. And I don't like this part either. It feels like leakage of some kind of guilty knowledge or something. He seems very nervous, and again, he's going out of his way to create confusion about what he was driving when all they asked him was how he walked to the trail system. Then the detective asks him where he saw the three girls, and then suddenly he relaxes again. He knows right where he saw them, his posture relaxes, and he seems comfortable talking about that experience. Now, if I had to make a bet, I'd say this part of his story is probably true. I think he really did see those girls, and that's why he's so comfortable talking about it. His demeanor and the way he talks about things when he wants to avoid something seem to really delineate the things that he's comfortable talking about and the things he's not comfortable talking about. He's comfortable saying he was there. He's comfortable saying he saw those girls. He's comfortable saying that he went out to the bridge, but he's not comfortable talking about where he parked, how he walked out to the trails, and why he was on the bridge. And again, these are all jumping out at me as, I hate to use an overused term, but as big red flags. So the detectives go on and they ask him again if he saw anyone else that day. And he says he doesn't remember seeing anyone else, but he qualifies that by saying if he did see someone on the bridge, they definitely didn't stand out to him because he doesn't remember. And again, it feels like he's hedging there. Like he saw someone on the bridge and he thinks that maybe someone knows that he saw someone on the bridge. He goes on to say that he used to trade stocks and he thinks that he left the trail so quickly that day because he wanted to get home and look at the stock activity on his computer. And after that, the detectives ask him what he was wearing that day. He's kind of hesitant to answer the question. He gives an, and then they jump in to remind him that he had said earlier that he put on a jacket. And remember, earlier he said, without question, he said it unprompted actually, that he put on a jacket and then went to the trails. And now he's kind of waffling on that. He said, I guess I would have maybe put on a jacket. It wasn't all that warm that day. Then he's noncommittal. He doesn't say what jacket he was wearing. He says over the years he's owned Carhartt jackets. He's had black ones and blue ones. And he says at that time it probably would have been a black one with a hood. But even that he doesn't commit to. He says it could have been a sweatshirt like the one he's wearing right now. Could have been a hoodie. He has lots of other jackets, etc. Then they ask him about a hat, any kind of headwear. And he says that he usually carried with him, he calls it a skull cap, but I think most people would call it like a beanie, kind of like a short stocking cap that's brown. And he says that if he had one, it would have been that because he usually would carry that with him. Then they ask him about shoes and he starts waffling again. Rather than answer the question about what shoes he was wearing, he just goes into all the different shoes and boots that he owns. In this part, who knows? It's hard to get a read on him. And he might just genuinely not remember which shoes he was wearing that day. Again, it's been 5.5 years. And this is where phase two of the interview ends. The interview portion is over, and around the 47-minute mark, they shift into interrogation.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you, and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Around the 47-minute mark, the tone of the interview shifts dramatically. The detectives ask Alan if they can examine his phone and try to find his old phone, the one he had owned back in 2017. And they spend several minutes talking about who his service provider is and how long he's had his phone. Seems like the detectives are trying to keep him off guard. They don't want him to get defensive, so they're trying to make the request, but at the same time, they're trying to keep it conversational. Alan says he's not sure if they still have the old phone. It might have been recycled. He'll have to ask his wife about that. And then Alan starts to get really concerned. He's visibly concerned. He's basically committed to letting them look at his current phone. But then as the detectives explains his rights regarding the phone, Alan says, quote, "I'm not going to be anybody's fall guy." He says that it seems like they may have think he did it. Now, the detective here starts to explain that they just need to verify his story so they can clear him if he deserves to be cleared. He says they'd like to look at his phone, his car, and his house. And Alan says he doesn't want people going through his house, and if they start to think he's a suspect, they can get a warrant for that. The detective tells him that they're just starting back at the beginning to try to clear everyone who was out on the trail that day. And Alan continues to push back. He says they can look at his current phone, but they'll need a warrant for anything else. And this part doesn't bother me. I'll never fault anyone for exercising their constitutional rights to privacy. He even says that he's concerned that if they search his house and if someone sees them doing that, or it leaks to the media, which is a legitimate concern, that everyone will think he's guilty of this. No doubt he's seen what's happened to other people along the way throughout the years of this case, so I don't fault him for that. But then, right when he's about to hand over his phone, he changes his mind on that too, and says that he needs to talk to his wife before he agrees to anything. And a few minutes into this part of the discussion, Alan actually says out loud exactly what I was thinking regarding his resistance to letting the police search his phone in his house. There can always be other reasons people get nervous about things like that other than being guilty of a crime. He tells the detectives that he doesn't want them looking through every website he's ever visited. It's just something to keep in mind that a lot of people have secrets, or at least things they don't want strangers to know about them, and that could be the driver for the resistance here. And at this point, one of the detectives leaves the room and comes back with Alan's original statement for him to review. And during this part of the conversation, the thing that sticks out to me is Alan's insistence that he was wrong back then about what time he got to and left the trails. With everything else, he's been saying it's been years, it's hard to remember, what he said back then must be accurate. But when it comes to the times, he says that what he said back then is incorrect. In his original statement, he said that he was on the trails and the bridge from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., which puts him there at the exact time that Abby and Libby were killed. But now he says there's just no way that's accurate. He definitely left by 1:30. He seems to obviously know that being at the scene during that time window is going to be a big problem for him. Now, after this, Alan seems pretty relaxed and confident again, as he says that he's not worried about them connecting him to the murders. He says there's nothing that's going to connect him to this case. He goes on to say that if he thought he had anything useful that would help the investigation, he'd be happy to let them search his things. But since he doesn't, he's not going to open the door to let them drag him into the situation. And again, in this part of the interrogation, he seems very confident and very relaxed, which is interesting to me. You guys kind of heard my thoughts as we've been moving through this. I've been getting more and more concerned about the parts of his story where he seems very uncomfortable, very nervous. But generally, when you shift into this mode in the read technique, once you get to the interrogation part, that's when you should see them getting nervous. You shouldn't see confidence building at this point if you have a guilty suspect. So that kind of, I'm kind of taken aback by that, because I was kind of leaning towards, oh, he very well may be guilty. But now his behavior here is kind of making me question that a little bit. And at the 1 hour and 6 minute point, the officers step out of the room for a bit. What they're doing is they're preparing to escalate the interrogation. They've shifted from interview to interrogation. They've got a little more confrontational. They've tried to get some evidence from him. They've tried to get access to his things to search. Now they're going to step back. And this is, if you've read the Reed Technique manual, you know exactly what's coming next. Now they're going to try to move into the kill. They're really going to put the pressure on. And that's exactly what they do. While they're gone, Alan's just chilling and texting on his phone, which again, caught me off guard. He seems very relaxed. He's definitely talking to someone because you can see that he's typing on his phone. But he doesn't necessarily look nervous. Now, when the cops return, they do exactly like I said. They shift into that amped up interrogation mode. Again, classic Reed technique. Now, if you watch the video, you'll notice that the investigator moves his chair around the table so that he's closer to Alan. That is straight out of the textbook. Now that they've built rapport, they've established a baseline, they got a story on the record, now's when the book says to move in for the kill. Present the suspect with evidence to try to rattle them. The book also tells you to move your chair closer to them, and as things escalate further, it actually suggests that you get so close that you touch them, like your knees touching each other. We never get to that point in this interview because, as you're going to hear, eventually Alan just ends the interview and walks out. So the detective starts with the surveillance image of Alan's car driving towards the scene that day. And then, and this is where Alan really gets pissed, he reveals that the police had people talking to Alan's wife and daughter while he was in there. And his wife and daughter revealed to the investigators that Alan had threatened suicide with a gun at some point. Now, Alan says it's not because he killed the girls. It's because he struggles with mental health issues, and he has for years. And he is getting confident, and he is getting pissed at this point. And then the detective presents him with the image of Bridge Guy and asks him straight out if that's him. Alan immediately denies it and says, even if it looks like him, it can't be him if the photo was taken from one of the girls' phones, because he says he's never met those girls. Then the detective really starts pressing. He points out that the guy in the picture, the Bridge Guy, is wearing exactly what Alan said he was wearing that day. And Alan, angry at this point, says, okay, we're done here. He doesn't get up, but he's skirting around, walking out of there. They try to calm him down, and he's just getting really agitated. His posture has changed, but it's not into a nervous posture. He's sitting back now, pulling away from the detectives with his arms crossed over his chest. He's visibly angry. And again, confidently says that he's not worried about them connecting him to the murder, but also that he himself noticed the shift in the interview. He actually verbalizes exactly what they did, which again is textbook Reed technique. Like I've said a few times today, Reed technique says first you build the baseline and rapport building, then interview to get a story on the record, then interrogation. Well, Alan says things have definitely taken a turn here. Now I feel like I'm being interrogated. And he's right. That's exactly what's happening. The detective keeps pushing, and Alan continues to exude confidence and conviction that he had nothing to do with these murders. At one point, the detective says that he knows either Richard was out there to kill those girls or to introduce them to the person who killed them. And Alan says, very confidently, quote, "Okay, good luck finding anything that points in that direction," end quote. The detective then reiterates that they want to search his phone, car, and house so they can clear him. And Alan says, quote, "That's not going to happen now. We're done here. Either arrest me or take me home," end quote. And after a few more minutes of the detective trying to get Alan to re-engage, Richard says, quote, "You've lost my trust. I'm not going to talk to you anymore. Now you've pissed me off." And then, "Are you arresting me?" And the detective deflects, and Alan says, "Am I free to leave?" And the detective says, "You've always been free to leave." And Alan says, "Thank you," gets up, and walks out. And the video ends with him saying to the detective, "You're an asshole." So that's it. That's my analysis on the entire 1 hour and 20 minute interview. Now, what I had thought at the beginning when I first had this idea to go through and break down this statement is to bring somebody on to go over it with me. Someone that is more of an expert than I am, because we all know I'm not an expert. But it's hard to do because everyone already has a bias. There are people that already have a guilty bias, people that already have an innocent bias. And I really wanted to get the take of someone that was completely neutral. Now, we have Dr. Shiloh, who I've sent a message out. I haven't heard back yet, but I'm hoping maybe we can get her on the follow-up to kind of discuss some of this, because she's about as neutral as they come. She doesn't really have a position one way or the other at this point, but she also does know things about the case. So as I was sitting there trying to think, who could I talk to, who could I have on that has 100% no bias about this, that will only look at, again, the analysis we're doing is just on this one statement. We're going to do the other statement. We're going to compare that all back to the evidence. But who could be completely unbiased and only analyze this data? And this is crazy. I've never done anything like this before. But the answer I came up with was AI. I wanted to plug in this entire interview into ChatGPT and have ChatGPT analyze it and find out what she thought about the interview. And yes, my ChatGPT is a she. So that's what I did. I was able to rip out the audio from the YouTube video that was posted and create a transcript of that audio. And then, I mean, this all took hours, but I uploaded both the transcript and the audio into AI and had them analyze it and break it down and tell me what they thought. So I got several analyses from the AI. And then I asked, give me a summary after you have listened to this entire interview. Do you think this interview makes Richard Alan look guilty? The prompt was a little more in depth than that, but essentially that's what I asked. And I was going to read to you AI's opinion about this interview with no bias whatsoever. This is just a computer analyzing data. So the responses broke down into a few segments. The first one is what the interview tells us. It says, Alan starts out calm and cooperative, even conversational. He seems prepared to be helpful. As questioning intensifies, his demeanor shifts. He becomes more defensive, repetitive, and emotionally strained. He gives unsolicited denials like, "I would never hurt a kid," which psychologists sometimes view as leakage, but also not uncommon under stress. He doesn't assert his right to an attorney, though he skirts the line a couple of times. That could suggest confusion, fear, or guilt, but it also might just reflect his lack of legal savvy. There are no confessions, no hard evidence presented to him, and no smoking gun moments, just mounting pressure and unraveling confidence. The next section is behaviorally speaking. His stress indicators, long pauses, repetition, verbal stumbles, could point to guilt, but could just as easily reflect fear of being wrongfully accused. The emotional breakdowns and contradictions do raise eyebrows, but they aren't definitive. Bottom line, based on this interview alone, there are signs that warrant serious suspicion, but not enough to conclude guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The psychological wear we see could stem from guilt or the fear of being misidentified in a high-profile case. To move forward toward any conclusion, we'd need physical evidence, DNA or forensic links, witness corroboration, or more subsequent interviews and his post-interrogation behavior. Conclusion, this interview paints Alan as a viable suspect, but not a conclusive one. It raises questions, but doesn't answer them. And that's it. So that's what ChatGPT thinks about this interview. I did this after I did my statement analysis because I didn't want to be biased by what AI had to say. And I agree with what the computer model says here. I think that it pretty much nailed it. To move forward with any conclusion, we have to have things like physical evidence, witness corroboration, and maybe some more interviews, which we're going to get another interview next week. So now that you heard what ChatGPT thinks about the interview, now I'll give you kind of a one paragraph summary of my analysis. Now, again, I don't want anybody listening to this and thinking that this is like the final word on guilt or innocence, that I've made up my mind. So based solely on my statement analysis of this hour and 20 minute interview, here are my takeaways. So I'm just going to read you exactly what I wrote when I finished this up yesterday. So I'm probably going to repeat something I just said, but here we go. Based solely on my statement analysis of this hour and 20 minute interview, here are my takeaways. It seems like Alan is hiding something. He clearly avoided the conversations about where he parked, how he walked to the trails, and why he was on the bridge that day. It seems clear to me that whatever he was doing there, he doesn't want anyone to know about. But the final 20 minutes of the interview lead me to believe that the thing he's hiding is not that he killed Abby and Libby. It seems like it's something else entirely that he's hiding. Everything about his behavior in those 20 minutes rang true to me. He was confident in his denial of involvement. He was angry about being accused, which is what you would expect from someone being accused of something they didn't do. As I said earlier, you don't expect confidence to go up during that hard-pressed interrogation phase, but Alan's did. So if I had to make a bet based solely on just this interview, my assessment would be that Richard Allen did not kill Abby and Libby, but he was doing something out there that day that he doesn't want anyone to know about. And to take that a step further, based on his avoidance of answering the question of if he saw anyone else, his car, where he parked, how he walked out there, I also think part of what he's trying to hide is not just why he was out there and what he was doing, but also who he was out there with. And that's it. Those are my thoughts on the October 13th, 2022 interview. I'm really anxious to hear what you guys think in this week's follow-up. Again, if you want to watch the interview, go to the Crime Circus YouTube channel and you'll see it there. Both interviews are there. I'm only covering this week the first one. So put in any questions you have, any thoughts, any theories in the post that Erica will put up on the Facebook page on Monday. If you're not on Facebook, you can always email us through the website. Any questions for the follow-up or comments? And again, I'm hoping that maybe we can get Dr. Shiloh to come on, be a part of that follow-up, because I'm curious about her thoughts of my analysis as we move forward. So that's this week. I'm going to wrap things up here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And next week, I'm going to be back covering the second interview, which is a much more intense interview. That'll be next week. The follow-up will be recorded on Tuesday, published next Friday. So we'll talk to you guys then. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And you can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers. Watch it work.